Hello and welcome to part one of our final episode of this series of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. What a journey we have been on discussing every step of breast cancer. In this episode, we are continuing with the patient voice as we discuss survivorship, living with and beyond cancer, and how they have learned to live their best lives despite cancer. Each of these women offers valuable insights and advice from their own unique experience, culminating in a conversation packed with information for anyone facing a similar journey, or those with family, friends, or work colleagues facing breast cancer. Let's get this episode started. Okay, so we're on to our final episode of Talking Breast Cancer podcast. And again, I'm going to say this is for patients and really, really important to take on board what Áine, Deirdre and Lisa are telling us, because these are the things that they wish they had known. And Áine, we met you in a previous episode.
You did.
And Deirdre, but would you mind introducing yourselves again?
No problem. My name's Áine and I was diagnosed in 2017. It was initially with early stage breast cancer, and surgery and radiotherapy had been part of my treatment plan, and then everything was going to go back to normal and I had a very positive very positive road ahead of me. But unfortunately, before the surgery happened, the scan showed that there was cancer in my spine. So it was now deemed incurable, which was a very scary word to listen to. So a different treatment plan was put in place. And when I heard the word incurable, I thought, oh my God, how do I live my life with incurable cancer? But I am here 5 years later, still on the same first line of treatment and feeling good.
Doing good. And you had your five-year
milestone. I had my five-year metaversary last week.
I love the terminology, metaversary. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, it's lovely to have you here again today,
Áine. Thank you.
And sure, we'll talk about living our best lives.
Mm-hmm, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Deirdre.
Thanks, Helen. I was diagnosed in 2019, in December, with metastatic breast cancer. I had it in my neck and under, well, they didn't know about my lymph nodes, but they kind of had an idea. So anyway, I had started treatment in the January in the COVID, and I was on it for 6 months. So then I had surgery. And unfortunately, after the surgery, I met with my surgeon and he said, no, it only 30% of the treatment worked. So I was put on immediately a new treatment plan, which has worked so for the last 2 years, and I feel good, no doubt about it. And I've been, as I call myself, stable Mabel. So thank God, that's all I can say. And it's all to do with, part of it is to do with positivity as well.
Mm-hmm, of course.
It really is, but I'm good.
Okay, thanks, Deirdre. So we have Áine Metaverse and we've got Deirdre Stable Mabel. It's going to be a good show. And Lisa, I'd love to welcome you today. Lisa is our new addition for our last episode. Lisa, you're very welcome. Lisa, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, yeah. Thanks, Helen. Just with your the little names, I guess I'd call myself Rollercoaster Rita. I was diagnosed in 2011 and I had mastectomy, chemotherapy, radiotherapy and a reconstruction. And then I think I probably got about 2.5 years before I had my next diagnosis. And since then, I guess, then it was like a new diagnosis every 18 months. And now it's just sort of a bit kind of quicker in that, in looking at it. So I suppose, you know, I've had a number of surgeries at different times. I've had concentrated chemo, and I guess I've been on chemotherapy now for probably 4 years. With different ones, I suppose, different lines of treatment, yeah, and more radiotherapy and all of the rest. So it's a bit of a different trajectory.
Yeah. And we said that earlier, Lisa. It's lovely to have you here. You're all unique.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we acknowledge that. And it's my privilege to have you all here again today, and my honour. I love talking to you. You know that. Okay, so I think we'll open up this this episode, and this really is about survivorship for some,
And we talk about survivorship in a very broad spectrum. But for you ladies, it's like living your best lives, because that's what I see. Mm. You know, I really see this in you. You're living your best lives always, despite cancer and despite ongoing treatment. One of the things I would like to kind of open up this conversation is around communication. Now we're on our fourth episode, so we've had three episodes previous to this. But we've talked about this before in our positive living group, and it's actually like shifting the mindset for medics, using different language, choices, and giving hope. Okay, how do you feel about that?
I think because they're your first point of contact, that it really is, you're watching their facial expressions or how they approach your illness, what way they're saying it to you. Because really, you're just don't know what's about to happen or how long treatment may go on for. So everything that they do is an indication of what you think they're thinking. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, it's very beneficial for them to explain the treatment to you and to give an idea of how the treatment may affect you, what illnesses you may get from it, what to watch out for, but also to give you that hope. Like, that hope is very important, that, you know, if this treatment isn't for you, there is another one. Because as you said earlier, we are all unique. So what treatment works for one person will be different for the next person.
Yeah. And Deirdre, what do you think about, I mean, we've something I didn't mention there was kind of the empathy and the time given to you when you're getting your diagnosis.
I think it's also body language. I had this on my second one. I had this thing, I was saying that at our last meeting, that everyone kept touching the bottom of my leg. No idea why, but I was like, there, and I was going, please stop doing that. Eventually said to a nurse, please stop doing this. You know, I'm going on new treatment. I just need people to reassure me. Mm-hmm. And it's what they're there for. Don't get me wrong. And it was lovely and all that. But when the fourth person has done it to you, you're kind of going, am I dying? Am I going? I'm not going to last or what? Mm-hmm. So it's just made aware of the impact it can have on your mind. Mm-hmm. And they are so good. There's no doubting that. And maybe some words that they say to you that, you know, can floor you. Mm-hmm. Absolutely floor you. Like, not great. Like, not great. What do you mean by not great? You know.
What do you mean by not great?
It's just to sit down and understand that what they're going to say to you is going to have such a huge impact on you. Mm-hmm. You know. So it's just for them to be aware of it. You know, really. And I'm sure they are, but it's just sometimes it comes out from them, and you're kind of going, oh my God, you know, what do you mean by this?
Yeah.
You know.
And I suppose, Anya, you said it in our previous episode. You know, that they do this every day. Yeah. And it's not taking that away from anybody, but it's just like you're there for the first time. You know, you're feeling this. It's changing your life. Yeah. And you want them to feel that for you, like not necessarily feel it, but to acknowledge that it's happening and be empathetic towards it.
Yeah, and I
towards
think
you.
A natural reaction of any patient, even when you're for the first time calling yourself a patient, it's even difficult. Mm. But to say the words, I have cancer, is very difficult. But certainly when a doctor comes in and tells you those words and you're sitting on a chair and really you are watching everything, not just the doctor, the nurse who may be in the room, other people in the background, it all starts to come back to you later. It's not necessarily on that day, at that time, your reaction happens. It's later on when you've got time to go home and think about what actually happened today, what was said to me today.
Yeah.
Is this real? Is this happening? You know?
Yeah. And Lisa, what are your thoughts on communication and what you've experienced yourself?
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with you that you're always looking for that other knowledge, that thing that you're not being told, or the thing that if you knew, could you be a little bit ahead of the game, or just, you know, is there something in the background? But I think communication changes over time. Like certainly when, in my experience, had been diagnosed as initially in 2011, there was a sense that everything was on, you know, that that you were very special, you know, you were very taken care of by this big team. And everybody was sort of working towards, you know, curing you, and every, I suppose everything was on. And then as, you know, the very thankful 11 years have passed, that sort of changes a bit, because I guess there's a presumption that you know, a lot about your illness, which you do, but you don't know as much as, you know, yeah. the specialists know. And that you're kind of emotionally over it. So certainly the giving of information is less careful, I suppose, and the caretaking of you when you receive it is less careful too. So you're just basically, you could be told, like, you know, potentially life-changing things in a phone call, which can be very traumatic.
Of course.
I sometimes think the sort of the trauma element of information is sidelined, and I guess there is just that expectation that, oh well, you've heard something similar before, so you know, you just get on with it, which of course you do get on with it, and you move on and you live your life and all the rest. There's a bluntness that just kind of, you know.
What do we want our listeners to know today? What do we want to tell people? There's an assumption that you've had this information already, so it's not so hard, but in fact, it's actually more difficult.
Yeah, you can manage it a bit yourself. Mm. Like, certainly something that I've begun to do is sort of is to say quite clearly, I don't want any more phone calls, okay. You know, which takes a big stress away, because you're not looking at your phone at, you know, missed numbers and private numbers and thinking, oh my God, you know,
okay.
And just going through that shock again. And so ensuring that things are face to face, that certainly means that you can box it and you're living your life otherwise, and you can keep medical things in the medical box to a certain extent.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think another part of it is when you are in the room and you've been looked after very well in a medical sense, that it would be very beneficial, I feel, if somebody from the team said, how are you coping? Because that question was never asked. So I automatically thought, I'm supposed to be coping with this. But in my head was spinning around, and it was very traumatic. But nobody was asking me how I was. And therefore, I thought I had to be okay.
Okay.
So I thought then, you know, the stress that I was going through and the roller coaster of emotions was wrong. It wasn't until I joined the Positive Living Group, I realized, oh my God, all these ladies are going through the same as me. Their thoughts are the same as me. Everything is the same. And it was really the first time I realized I'm okay to feel the way I'm feeling. But that was nearly a year later.
Yeah.
It took me a year to reach out.
Time lost. Mm-hmm. I'm okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
It's okay not to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've heard that previous times too.
I did the webinar with the Marie Keating Foundation, and at that stage, I just couldn't find somewhere, like what you said, Anya, I couldn't find somewhere that I could actually speak to people who were in the same position. And I contacted yourself, Helen, and it was the first time I went out was at Tala, and we had a day out there, and that we met face to face. And I remember saying to you, this is about living.
Yeah.
This is, and I mean, I was like, as if I was, someone wrapped me around in cotton wool before and just said, you know, grow off now and enjoy your life.
Mm.
You know, you live with cancer. Now, I'm not saying it's easy. Don't get me wrong. It's far from easy. But there is some time at some part of your life with this that you have to think you can enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
You're allowed enjoying yourself. But that's one thing yourself, Helen, and the Marie Keating did for us. Brought us into with people who like-minded, same different conditions of whatever of cancer, but we're on a WhatsApp and all we have to do is put something in and next minute everyone's on and helping and whatever.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
There's a lot of tender, you know, loving care within that group, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh my God.
And if my memory serves me right, we were having a garden party or a festival, as one of our colleagues called it on the day. So nice memory there, Deirdre.
Yeah, it was a lovely memory.
Lovely. Yeah. Okay.
I'd just like to add a bit about that as well, if I could. The Marie Keating was the first, I suppose, support group that I had ever joined after I I think I'd been probably 8 years diagnosed at that stage. And I think probably what was holding me back from ever getting involved with something was along the lines of, you know, you're kind of barely coping with your own, even though you're living your life, you know, fully and all of the rest. And you kind of feel maybe sometimes joining a sort of support group, does it mean that you're going to have to be coping with other people and supporting other people? And it was one of the most positive things that, you know, and helpful things in joining, in just, you know, taking the big step and getting involved with the first group that I was involved with. It was, like you're saying, it was just so freeing and so helpful. It was like a big weight being in a room, lifted, being in a room with people who had shared the same.
It's empowering, isn't it?
Very empowering.
To be in a space that where actually you say, you talk a sentence and everybody understands. They just get
what you're talking
about. They get you and you get them.
But you don't get that look when the head goes
to
the side.
You don't get any looks.
You probably get a puck instead of a look. It's like, come on, cop onto yourself.
How are you? How are you?
You can't see it, but
take
it from me.
The eyes.
Lisa, I'm going to bring up something that you said there that's really important, and you talked about trauma. And like, if we're in this kind of supportive space and we're wanting to live our best lives, how do we manage that? Do we seek counselling or psychological support? Is it available?
I've had a fair bit over the past 11 years at different stages, and kind of I felt like a tennis ball, kind of just knowing for the sake of my family that I need some, you know, I need to be able to deal with stuff outside of the home. And I remember the first counselor that I saw, I really don't know what she said to me, but I just went to her room and I cried for an hour once a week, and that was really, really helpful. It meant I didn't have to do that to my husband, you know. And then I just said, I'm sorry, I've had enough now, and went off for another few years.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, but it was really good. Like,
very therapeutic.
It was very therapeutic for me. And, you know, I'm sure that woman was very skilled. She didn't really get a chance to practice any of her skills because I just.
She
allowed me the space. Yeah. And then different, you know, I've had neuropsychology for trauma specifically, which was very, very helpful. And I'd probably call it life changing for me in terms of realizing things that, you know, things that were happening to my mind were not to do with me and the person that I was, but were to do with that I had experienced ongoing trauma. And the psychologist, and they were a qualified psychologist, said to me, it's a bit like you have been put against a wall with a firing squad, and they've raised their rifles and they said, we're going to shoot you, and then they don't, and then 6 months later it happens again, and then it happens again and again, and you have to learn to deal with that. The good news is that you can actually deal with that with the proper strategies. You know, and that was just amazing, you know.
I'm just listening to Lisa and I'm kind of overwhelmed by what you're saying. And some people, I suppose, put barriers up, don't they, to seeking that psycho-oncology help or the psychological help.
Yeah.
What's your message to them?
Well, I would have been full of barriers because, you know, I'd have a skill base that would make me realize that I'm quite informed about everything. I'm able to, you know, manage things myself. But while I had cancer, you know, my children were very young at that stage, and marriage and all the things at work, all the things that people have in their lives. And I began to realize maybe that my patience was less, you know, I'd be getting a bit out of control. And of course, many people in this situation are managing menopausal symptoms, and you're trying to work out, is it my bunky brain? Is it my menopause? What is it? But things weren't right. So I was gay, you know, I've sort of said to my family, you have to let me know when, you know, I'm getting a bit out of control, and then I go to counselling.
Okay, good. So it's about like getting that support from your family as well. And maybe you're not identifying it as much as they are, and getting that kind of alert.
Yeah. It's even like a raised voice. It's when I start communicating in a slightly more anxious way, when my voice changes, then they kind of know, oh, ma'am.
Looking out for you. Yeah. Good strategy. What about you, Deirdre? Have you seeked out any kind of... Yeah?
Yeah, I've done it about 4 times.
Okay.
If I feel any way down, I just make a phone call to ARC and I've gone in. I'm in the middle of it doing it at the moment because I'm trying to decide whether I'm going back to work, and I've just had a few issues. Nothing major, but just, you know, get them out there. And it's just amazing. It really is amazing.
So that's counselling and talking through any
everything,
issues that are arising,
you know,
for you.
And we have a laugh. This woman and myself just hit it off for the last few weeks. And we have a laugh, but we also have very serious conversations. And I find it really beneficial.
Yeah,
no,
that's good.
Because there's things you can't say to your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because it just frightens them, you know.
So it's like a personal space again,
yeah,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Anya, yourself, have you?
Yeah, at the very beginning, I think I did everything because that's what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's saying, have you done this? Have you done that? So you've been led by the hand and pushed through the door. But I think, yeah, you know yourself when the anxiety levels start to go up that you need to do something. So, yeah, certainly I've done everything, really. Anything that's on offer, I'll put my hand out and grab hold of it. But I have to say, since I've met the group, the Positive Living, I haven't felt I needed to do anything because it just keeps me on an even keel. The fact that we do the calls every 2 weeks during COVID, or we meet up every 4 weeks, those 4 weeks I can do or say, or, you know, at that meeting, and I'm back feeling great and get on with life with my family again.
Good.
So I really keep everything up for those 4 weeks.
Yeah, good. So there's a clear message there, I think, from all three of you, isn't there? That, like, that kind of seeking that psychological support or counselling, whatever you can and avail of, is really, really positive. Mm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Great. I suppose there are many other kind of supportive services that we'll mention. We probably won't be able to talk about them in such detail, but, you know, nutrition and exercise are very practical things, aren't they? But they're so beneficial, aren't they, in terms of how energized you are, how you give nutrient to your body, and how you kind of manage those kind of fatigue symptoms. And are you open to, or have you been open to seeing a dietitian and going on exercise programs or doing your own exercise programs?
I'm with, I started with Xwell.
Okay.
I obviously left everything to this year. I started with Xwell last week, the hottest day of the year. And it's all to do with resistance, aerobics, weights, and their age range from 40s up to 80s. And everyone's out there doing it. But it is so good. Twice a week.
And how did you get there, Deirdre?
I had to go. Yes, it's hooked up to with the matter. So I had to get the reference, had to be from the matter or your GP.
Okay.
But it's good, really
good. Know,
it's really good. I'd recommend it. It's run by Noel McCafferty, who's actually, he set it up for cancer patients, but now it's for diabetes, it's for heart.
Yeah.
It's great that it's
chronic conditions,
you know, for long-term illnesses.
Yeah.
And then people meet and they have a chat and whatever, you know. It's not like us, don't get me wrong, we don't. It's not long conversations, but I mean, we have a bit of fun as well. But it is very good.
So you're releasing all those positive endorphins.
Yeah.
Yeah. But exercise is great, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Nobody ever regrets a walk or...
Oh, walking's great.
A run, maybe, but a walk. I might ask you about nutrition, Lisa. Do you find nutrition is a very important aspect of how you manage yourself and keep yourself well?
I think it is, but not in a really kind of dogmatic way. Because I've tried them all. I've tried the sugar free. Like, I have actually, you know, I went sugar free for like a year, which nearly killed me. didn't make any difference. I think probably just having a really like lots of veg, lots of fruit, being good to yourself, having your treats is probably, you know, the best thing. Like, luckily it was easier for us because I had been vegetarian for a long time before I had children, and it was another kind of lactose intolerant person in the house, and so we were always able to adapt to funny diets anyway. But we don't, that one, be really clear, we don't do that now. We just try and eat really healthily, One of the things actually that I learned more recently was the importance of protein. And I probably, that was something that I wasn't as aware of, just, you know, about getting a bit of protein in at every meal for your muscles to, you know, because everything in cancer, chemotherapy, everything will affect your muscles and just to give yourself the best chance. But touching, you know, looking after gut health, touch your base if you can with a dietitian or just, you know, is really, find it really helpful.
And I suppose for our listeners, if you can, you know, touch base with a dietitian in your oncology centre, and some of the cancer support centres will have that kind of support as well. They'll have nutritionists or dietitians within within their circle. Something else I'd like to bring up is the medical social worker. And I find, you know, even talking in the group, that most of you now may have met a medical social worker, but not at the beginning. Okay. And they're very valuable, you know, support in terms of looking at the, you know, what benefits you might be able to have. Deirdre, you talked about going back to work there, but some people don't go back to work. Mm-hmm. And some people, as we know in our group, have had to take early retirement because they're not able to go back to work. They're physically not able to go back to work. So there's lots of issues going on for people individually. And for me, the medical social worker is the person who has kind of got that knowledge and can actually direct you further. So would you have seen a medical social worker on you?
I personally haven't seen a medical social worker, not yet. And that's 5 years into my journey. But I presume I could request an appointment with them. But I figured everything out myself, which was the hard way to do, especially the likes around the medical card and leaving work and other things that you may be entitled to, like maybe the bus pass and things like that, that you're just figuring things out by yourself, really. And I don't know whether that's because I was an outpatient and have been an outpatient all the way along my journey, whether the social worker only steps in once you become an inpatient. I'm not really too sure, but it would be
beneficial
to know.
And Deirdre, have you?
I saw one last week, actually.
Good.
Which was really helpful. Yeah, well, look, it was really helpful, and talking around a range of issues, you know, because social workers are so highly skilled, and, you know, they kind of touch base with all of the people involved with the care. So you're able to talk about the kids, you're able to talk about, you know, a few things, and then get steered in the right direction for other options.
Yeah.
I work, but I've, throughout the past 11 years, I've come in and out of the workforce and changed career a number of times to suit, you know, what's happening with the cancer. I've lived overseas for a really long time, and that has really, I suppose, impacted access to support in Ireland, because I'd have very little PRSI now. You know, we have a big diaspora returning people back and forth. Yeah. So I'm sure there's a lot of people out there in that situation. Yeah. And I just say to people, you know, talk to your GP, talk to a social worker, and might be a little bit of future planning, you know, over 6 months or a year, or, you know, something like that, to see what you can do. But it is very, very tricky when you don't have PRSI, or you don't have enough PRSI, or you don't have it from, you know, you have enough for the past 2 years, but it's the third year ago that's the important one, and all of those kind of funny things in the system here.
So listening to you there, Lisa, I would imagine you would recommend that our listeners, you know, given the situation they might be in at an early stage, go and actually request a medical social worker.
Yeah. And in my experience, the hospitals you don't have to be an inpatient to have access. You just have to ask.
Yeah. And another very useful resource, of course, is Citizens Advice. They're very, very helpful. You know, if you're not necessarily, if you don't want to be in the hospital space or it doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. Now, we did, we talked a little bit about altered body image earlier. Deirdre, you talked about losing your hair and your eyebrows and how that made you feel. There are many, many, you know, other, I suppose, side effects and things that happen with having treatment. And it might even be around fatigue, sleep, pain, you know, the hot flushes. Lisa, you mentioned menopause. weight gain, weight loss, sexual function. Oh my God, there's so much there, isn't there? Depression, and kind of lymphedema. They're all, I suppose, those unwanted lingering effects that happen during and post-treatment, but you're not post-treatment, so they're lingering mm-hmm. for those, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And it seems like quite a trauma, doesn't it, to be trying to deal with this.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot put on your shoulders mm. and a lot of things that you know will happen, but they may not necessarily have happened just yet. Mm. But it's the worry and the fear, knowing that, well, you could lose your hair, you may have surgery, you might have a mastectomy, you're going to go through the menopause. There's just so much, and lymphedema, which happens and needs to be dealt with pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But there's a certain amount of things that you kind of really do need to know up front to make sure that these things happen and there is no delay in your treatment.
Yeah. Like for you, Lisa, just being in treatment and, you know, when we talked last, you talked about the palliative care team that you got involved with.
Mm.
How did that come about?
That sounds very dramatic, but I had a period in hospital recently enough, and it was probably the first time that I was it was the first time I was admitted to hospital due to the cancer as opposed to a side effect from cancer treatment. So before it would have just been for surgery or, you know, the effects of surgery, like an infection or something like that. Mm. And it's very kind of different then when it felt very different to me to be admitted due to what the cancer was doing to my body at that point in time. And anyway, I was there for a while and I just, you know, realized that, well, if things get much worse or in the future, you know, I really don't want to be in hospital at the end of my life. You know, it was a big thing to have to think about. But yeah. I became very sure of that. And it was a worrying time. So we didn't really know how things were going to play out. But after that, I approached my GP and put my big girl boots on and said, look, you know, I would like you to be involved and manage, if you would, you know, when the end of, you know, care happens. Mm. And she was very sensible and she said, it's fabulous that you're in here talking to me about this. What we'll do is we'll get it all sorted. We'll put it in a box and lock it away for, you know, the future, the long time future when we need to have this conversation. And so she referred me to the palliative care team. Mm-hmm. And also like to put things in place, but also for symptom management. Which, you know, which was great and very kind of rational thing to do. Mm-hmm. So a couple of weeks later, actually very quickly, I had a call from the local palliative care team and they came out and saw me and we talked about, you know, their role in helping to manage symptoms. I didn't have any pain, but to me, pain is something that gets in the way of people living their lives. Mm. It's really unnecessary. Mm. And I'm very scared of it as well, actually. You know, I don't want to have my life, you know, bothered by pain. And in this day and age, I don't think it's necessary. So it was great to be able to talk to people, you know, who just, their role is to address that. You know, yeah. The hospital addresses its thing, but they can't help. Like the hospital is in the hospital and you live your life outside of it. Mm. And so it was wonderful to know that there's people who, if you need that, you know, when you need that, will help you address that. So, you know, they've kept in touch and that'll probably peter off. And I was able to talk to them about, you know, my plans, things I'd like to happen. And it's been really positive because I guess it's been an opportunity to express my deepest fears in a really rational, proactive way, and then box them, put them in the box, you know, and know that I have a support in place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's so important, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. But certainly, like if I'm at home now and if there's things that are maybe lower level symptoms, you know, that maybe aren't directly addressed by, say, something that, you know, the oncology team, mm-hmm. the oncologist would feel is within their remit. I now know, well, I have my GP and I have the palliative care team to support me with other things, yeah. which is great.
Really yeah. important. Great. And yeah. I really want our listeners to hear that, because palliative care is about managing your symptoms as well. You know, so mm-hmm. managing those symptoms when they're early
yeah.
and not letting them get out of control.
Yeah.
And not getting into crisis management is really, really important. So it's managing symptoms to what Lisa is talking about there. And Lisa, thank you for your openness around end of life and having control over that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So important.
Yeah, it gives you, there's so little that you have control over in this whole game that it's quite, you know, consoling. To be able to do
charge.
That. You're in charge. Yeah. yeah, consoling is the wrong word to do it. Just, you know, yeah. it's, yeah.
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 Thank you, Lisa, for sharing that. And again, it's difficult to hear, but this is open and honest, and that's what we agreed to do. And what I'd like to come back to there is, like, you know, all those symptoms that we mentioned, they can happen. They happen to some people, you know, and others get very little in the way of symptoms. Or are these lingering effects? But it's really important to track them and to think, what is it? What is it that's happening to me now? What do you think is causing that? And what strategies, you know, or ways can you help yourself? And if that's not resolving itself, you've got to almost do what Lisa has done, you know, in terms of managing yourself and allowing yourself the best possible, like, way of living, you know, because when your symptoms are managed and mm-hmm. you're not in pain, and it's not necessary, really, yeah. Lisa, as you said, you know, when you meet a palliative care team early, lots of these symptoms can be managed. Okay, so we're coming to the end of our session, and thank you so much, Áine, Deirdre, and Lisa. I know there are a couple of things that you wanted me to say on the podcast too around national issues, and really, it's about, and I feel it within you that you really want people to know and understand what metastatic breast cancer is. It isn't just breast cancer. It is, you know, cancer that's spread to other parts of the body, and it's incurable. And we've heard that in our last episode and right now. So we really want people to be educated around that and around the whole communication strategy in the healthcare profession, but everywhere, actually, yeah. everybody understanding this. And that said, it is very personal. We've said it before, you're very unique. And I really hope that anyone who has metastatic breast cancer and those listening today will get that support they need. It's out there. And I hope you don't have to search too much. Thank you, Áine, Deirdre, and Lisa.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thank you again to our wonderful guests for their inspirational insights and learnings. To our sponsors, Novartis and Roche, for their support in making this series possible. And to you for tuning in. Join us next time where we will once again be talking all about breast cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more information on breast cancer awareness and support.